Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome back to the Daily Jungle. Big, big Thursday and lots to get to. The Dodgers may be sitting on 91 wins on the last day of August, but four straight losses has some people smashing the panic button. Also, after the Hamilton Ticats hired and fired Art Briles in a week, it turns out they also brought in none other than Jonathan Paul Manziel for a workout. You'll never guess how that went. And we had four excellent guests. Michigan State basketball coach Tom Izzo came in. We talked about the passing of legendary coach Judd Heathcote. Brewers third baseman Neil Walker joined us as Milwaukee chases a wild card spot. Dabo Swinney, legendary as always. And my man Alex Solis made a surprise appearance live in studio to talk jungle racing and horse racing. Alvy, go ahead and get it. I want to talk about the LA Dodgers because this has been a thing. You know, I've been on record as saying that they were the best LA Dodgers team that I'd ever seen. And then I said they were the best Dodgers team that I'd ever seen. And then I said they were the best baseball team I think I've ever seen. And then they'd lose a game, and then the Dodger haters would come out. Maybe even lose two, and the Dodger haters would come out, and I'd tell them to back the hell off. Well, now they've lost four in a row. Four in a row. So where does that leave us? You know me. I'm objective. I've got no dog in that fight. I don't care who wins and loses. So I've got no problem saying, after watching them this week lose four in a row, now would be a very good time to sound the panic alarm. They lost again. That's four in a row. So yes, now would be a very good time to freak out. They're not going to make the postseason. And if they do, they're probably one and done. They're not going to make any noise when they get there. Write it down. You don't like that car. That may have been one of the all-time great manual buzzers. That's how strongly I feel about that. That is such a lame take. That is so whack. They're not going anywhere. See? Listen, I'm not going to guarantee. Thanks, Dell. I'm not going to guarantee. That's Dell Harris if you need him.
That's whack.
You probably heard that over the years and wondered who that was. Former Laker coach Dell Harris. Back in the day, I would say things like, that's whack.
That's
and
whack.
Dell came on the show and he just said, that's whack.
That's whack.
Dell was awesome. What up, Dell?
That's whack.
It is whack, Dell. Because it couldn't be further from the truth. Look, I'm not going to guarantee a World Series in October, but I'm not going to rule it out because they lost four games in August. The Diamondbacks punked the Dodgers for five runs in the first inning on Tuesday. They beat them up for three more in the first inning last night. They stretched that to a 6-0 lead before the Dodger bats woke up. And while they did what they've been doing all year long and they mounted a late-inning comeback, it was just too little too late. Which means they now officially have themselves a losing streak. And I'm looking at y'all on Twitter and email and people are freaking out. So to you, my message is this. Chill the hell out. If you're a Dodger fan and you're gripping this hard, this means you think this means that you won't win in the postseason. Man, just settle down. If you're a Dodger hater and you're using this four games as evidence that they can't win in the postseason, shut up. They still have a 17-game lead in the division and the best record in baseball by a mile. The Diamondbacks are red hot. They came out swinging in this series. They mashed the Dodgers starting pitcher. Rich Hill throws a 9-inning no-hitter, and then he gets roughed up by the D-backs in his next outing. Hyun-Jin Ryu, who rarely gives up home runs, gave up two in the first and three in four innings, so he was off too. Yeah, they've lost four in a row. It's also the first time they've lost four in a row. Think about that. They nearly made it through August without losing four straight. Dave Roberts said as much after the game, quote, up to this point, we have played very good baseball. We had guys step up and be the stopper, whether it's two games or three games, even one game for us. This is uncharted territory for us this year, end quote. He also pointed out this obvious fact. The two teams that they lost to have been pretty damn good. It's the Brewers and the Diamondbacks. It's not like they're getting swept by the Phillies and the Mets. Justin Turner also said, quote, it's good for us going through adversity, dealing with stuff we haven't dealt with in a while. Like, normally I would say that's a load of crap, that losing is never good. But in this case, Turner's right. It is. It's a nice little wake-up call for a team that has been steamrolling everybody in sight. So now they've hit a bump. Now they have to dig a little bit deeper. Now they have to respond. And they will. They're getting healthier. They just got Cody Bellinger back last night. They're getting Clayton Kershaw back tomorrow. You think having the soon-to-be rookie of the year and the best pitcher in baseball might make a difference? I do. Last night was not about the Dodgers or the Diamondbacks. It was about the karma, the ultimate test for jungle karma. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovello and Dodgers outfielder Curtis Granderson both came on the show yesterday. Both did great interviews. Then they squared off a few hours later. So what was going to happen? Who would have the karma? Would it be an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object? Yes, yes, and yes. Because the only unstoppable force in this world is the karma. It goes where it wants. It impacts who it wants. And last night, it impacted both. Granderson, home run, walk, two RBI. Lovello, sixth straight win, second straight over the best team in baseball. Yes, I said it, the best team in baseball, because that's what the Dodgers are and what they will remain until somebody beats them four times in a seven-game series, not four times in August. Chill the hell out. Dodger fans, chill out. Dodger haters, chill out. They're fine. They're fine. Dabo Swinney is my guest. So we're just under 48 hours from the start of the season. So let me start here. When you're coming off a national championship, how do you go about approaching the season? Are you the defending national champs, or are you just another team that's looking to win one?
Yeah, we're definitely not defending anything. That's something that I tried to make real clear when we started over, you know, back in February. I mean, because if it was the same exact team coming back, then maybe we could be the defending champs, but it's not. We're a new team, new challenges, new journey, new chemistry, new leadership, new commitment, everything. You don't get to stay at the top of the mountain. You literally have to start over every single year. So I've told our guys we're the attacking champions. You know, to me, when you're defending, it just sounds passive. You know, we want to attack everything that we do here, and so we got a lot of guys that are champions, but. We're not defending. We're attacking to try to go, you know, win another one or continue to attack our goals that we set forth, because we don't have a goal that says win the national championship. That's just a byproduct of what can happen if we, you know, do a good job with our main goals that we strive for every year.
All right, so you mentioned goals. In fact, you have five goals each season, and those have not changed this year. For those who do not know, what are the goals and why are they important?
Yeah, they've been there since I got the job in 2009, and we set. I think it's important, first of all, that you create direction and you have a vision for your program, and then as a leader, you articulate that vision, and then you got to create the buy-in and put the right people in place to help work toward that. And so we have goals for our players that, like, this is what we want for our players. We want them to graduate. We want to equip them with tools for life that they're going to need. We want to make sure they have a great college experience, and we want them to win a championship of some sort. That's what we want for them as players. But then our team goals are very simple. We want to win the opener. We want to win our division, win our state championship, win the ACC, and win the closer. And, that has changed. That's the only thing that's changed from day one, and that is because in 2015, you know, we played for the national championship and got beat. And, you know, we get back, and it's one of the first things I look at when I walk in the team room. We've had those goals hanging on the wall since 2009. And that's what I told the team. I said, guys, this is my fault. You know, because from day one, I've always said that if we hit all five goals in one season, we would win it all. Well, our team hit all five of those goals. You know, we won the bowl game. But, you know, since 2009, they changed the rules on me a little bit. So I came back in the spring and I said, so here's what we're going to do, guys. We're going to, instead of win the bowl game, it's just going to say win the closer. And now, if we hit all five of those, we're going to win it all. And then we did that this past year. We hit all five goals. So, you know, just excited that we got an opportunity to start over, start fresh, and you know, go attack this new challenge.
Clemson head football coach Dabo Swinney joining us. Now, you named Kelly Bryant as your starter at quarterback. What was it that set him apart from the other options?
Yeah, just consistency and just day in and day out. He just won the job. I mean, you have to create competition, and it's all spring, summer, all fall camp, and to this point, he's won every phase of the competition. So there hasn't been a tie. He's won it. And so he's earned the opportunity to go start. Now, in college football, you know, we don't get preseason games. So when we play, the scoreboard is for real. So the next step for Kelly is to go continue to win the job on game day. And if he'll just do three-quarters of what he's done on our practice field, he's going to be a really good player. But, you know, I got to see it, and he's got to go do it. But based on what's happened in practice, you know, his decision-making, he's just in everything, consistency in the run game, the protections, the throws, and his confidence and his leadership, all of those things have put him on top for now. Now, we got two freshmen that are not going to go away and going to continue to compete and want to prepare for their opportunity, and at some point they'll get a chance to play as well. But, you know, where we are right now, Kelly definitely gives us the best chance to win.
Now, Dabble, one more thought about him. He's following in the footsteps of Taj Boyd and Deshaun Watson. An incredible tradition to be stepping into, and a lot of players might feel a lot of pressure to try to live up to that. How do you go about making sure that Kelly Bryant just tries to be Kelly Bryant and not Taj or Deshaun?
Right, and that's a great comment. Well, for me, you know, I think it started in the spring. Obviously, when you have a guy like Deshaun Watson who leaves your program, he's left such a huge shadow and legacy here. And it was important to me early on to make Kelly understand that, hey, listen, son, when I went and recruited you, I didn't recruit you to come be Deshaun. You know, I recruited you to be Kelly Bryant. You earned your scholarship based on who you are and what you've done and how you've lived your life and how you've performed on the field and off the field and academically. He was almost a 4.0 student in high school, and he's been a great student here. And my whole message to him was, listen, your job is to be the best version of Kelly Bryant, and guess what? That's what we want. That's what we recruited. He's going to bring certain things to the table that Deshaun didn't bring. So I think it was very important to make sure that we – got on the same page with that, and we articulated that as same thing with our other quarterbacks. Zarek Cooper, Hunter Johnson, told them the same thing. You know, you guys, we recruited y'all because we felt like you fit our culture, you could be great in our system, and you were the type of leader that we want here.
Last thought, you've got a philosophy that I want you to share if you could, and I've got a couple of minutes. Winning a national title is supposed to be the greatest moment of a coach's life or a player's life, but you've made the point it's still not good enough. You won a title as a player and now as a coach, and you've said to your guys they need to bottle that feeling and then go dominate life. Can you lay it out for us? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, I experienced it as a player, and I think sometimes you always hear me talk about living your life with a windshield mentality. And I think sometimes when you have big moments like that, you know, people live their life with a rearview mentality, and they get so caught up or defined on what they did in the past, whether it was great or bad. And I mean, I have, you know, I still have, you know, some of my teammates that's still how they're identified by, is what happened in that game, or that was the greatest moment in their life. And I don't want that for our players. I want our players to under, yeah, that was awesome, and we're going to get together in 10 years and have another great moment celebrating that. But it's really the journey to get there. And that's really what I wanted to capture in what I was saying to him, is, man, let's all that stuff that helped us get, let's bottle that up. You bottle that up. You take all those lessons, all those successes and failures and relationships and those tools that we've equipped you with, and go dominate life, man. That's what I really wanted them to have. And that's where the other thing is, understand that there's going to be other great moments in your life. This is awesome. And sometimes over the past off season here, I've had a lot of people say, well, it's kind of like, oh, you won the national championship, so now what? And I'm like, oh, you'll never be able to. You can't be excited. You've already done it. So it's like, and I'm like, you don't understand, you know. And they almost make it. I've said a couple times, it's like Clark Griswold and Rusty standing there at the Grand Canyon going, yep, Rusty, that's the Grand Canyon, you know? And they look at each other for about 30 seconds and go, ready to go? And boom, they're out of there. You know, it's not a Grand Canyon moment. It's one of those things that you want to go do again, and it's very motivating. And so if you're a senior on that team, you're not going to get a chance to go win a national championship as a player again, but that don't mean you can't take all that stuff and be highly motivated to go create other great moments in your life. And for our team coming back, it's not demotivating when you do something like that. It's motivating to go do it again. Just ask the Tom Brady's and those people, you know, what they're doing it for. And it's because of the journey. It's because of what it takes. It's the commitment. It's a special thing to experience, that's for sure.
When I shattered one record after another with that unprecedented run of rants about the Jacksonville Jaguars, I did not expect to be coming back days later with another streak to rival that one. Now, something like that is a once-in-a-lifetime streak. Lightning in a bottle. Something that we could all just sit back and appreciate. I know I did. So then I did my take on the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Art Briles Tuesday. I hadn't talked about the CFL in a long time. No Tiger Cats talk. No Blue Bombers bashing. No Red Blacks roundtable. No Argonauts arguing. I had not done anything on the Rough Riders with a space or the Rough Riders without a space in a long time. So I had to think that Tuesday was a one-off. Man, I was wrong. Because here we are, 48 hours later, and the Ticats are back at it again. Just days after they hired Art Briles and then fired Art Briles in a matter of hours. Now comes word from TSN that Hamilton worked out one Jonathan Paul Manziel last week. They really are looking to outdo themselves. That's a hell of a week now. Hire a guy who ran one of the worst programs in America and then work out one of the biggest busts in America. Fantastic job, Hamilton. But I've got to give him credit. They're trying everything. And kicking the tires on Manziel, unfortunately for Johnny, went about as well as you might expect. According to TSN, quote, among other concerns, the Ticats were not convinced Manziel is in game shape or that his off-field regimen is consistent with that of someone dedicated to professional football, end quote. Or to put it another way, there were, according to one source, quote, too many red flags. Stop on that for a minute. Ponder that for a minute, because that's got to be the most damning thing that's ever been said about Johnny Manziel, and it's not even close. The team that hired Art Briles looked at Manziel and thought, too many red flags. They brought in a guy who cannot get a job in America, a guy who ran a program where his players were accused of more than 50 rapes in 4 years. And that was all right with the Ticats. But they saw Manziel and thought, oh, no, too many red flags. I mean, incredible. But according to PFT, it's not completely dead yet. The team is still interested in him, and there's still a chance that Manziel could end up in Hamilton. Red flags and all. I mean, I'm not even sure how to react other than to say, that's just Hamilton going Hamilton. And no, this is not going to turn to some chance for the rest of you Canadian clones to dump on the proud, shiny, an up-and-coming city of Hamilton. This is not about the city that gave us Martin Short and Tim Horton. This is about the football team that's 0-8 and making one bizarre decision after another. Let's hire Art Briles. Let's give Johnny Manziel a workout. Hey, maybe they should check out RG3. Oh, wait. They actually do already have his rights. Of course they do. How much more Hamilton Tiger Cat could you get than a potential quarterback depth chart of RG3 and Manziel and Art Briles calling the plays? What? Joe Walrus Ruffles didn't want any of that? O.J. Simpson's going to be released in a little over a month. At this rate, you know the Ticats are going to want to know what he's got left in the tank. I've gone years without mentioning the Tiger Cats. But now I've gone deep on them twice in a single week. Can I make it a hat trick tomorrow? I'm not going to force it. In fact, I'm going to avoid it. But knowing the Tie Cats, they're going to do something and force their way right back onto this show. And then we'll be looking at three. Neil Walker is my guest. Neil, it's great to have you on this show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
Neil, thanks for doing it. So you're coming off that huge 6-5 win over the Cards yesterday. Keon Broxton, of course, made the game-saving catch, went back from the wall. What did you see on that going through your mind, Neil, as it unfolded?
Yeah, it was, we have Corey Kinnear, who's got unbelievable stuff, and he gets two strikes on a guy. You usually don't see a lot of hard contact. The ball was hit pretty well, obviously, and it looked like it, off the bat, that it was going to be a home run, and Keon kind of moseyed on back there and got himself to the wall in a good position and made just a tremendous catch. So, those are the type of things that you need to have go your way in seasons that end and hopefully playoff runs. So, was a big moment for us as the Milwaukee Brewers.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say it like that, because I was going to say, but when it's in the middle of a playoff chase in late August and you get a win with a clutch play like that, does it feel even bigger?
Well, I think the one thing you look for this time of year in baseball is making sure that you win the games that you're supposed to win, that you have the leads on late in the game, and winning series is so important, whether it's a 3-game series or a 4-game series, whatever the case may be. And you know, days like yesterday where we had a 2-game series and got boat raced the first day against St. Louis at home, it was I think it was important to lock that win down, and we got ourselves a little cushion and got ourselves into the ninth with a great closer, and fortunately we were able to come away with it. But you know, those are the things you hope that can carry you into big series, and like we have coming up with the Nationals and the Cubs in a few series. So big moments for us.
Milwaukee Brewer Neil Walker joining us. And Neil, I had your former Mets teammate Curtis Granderson on yesterday. We talked a little bit about the experience of being dealt in the middle of the season. You went from the Mets to the Brewers about 2 weeks ago. What was your initial reaction when you heard about that trade?
Yeah, you know, obviously in New York with the Mets, we had a lot of veteran guys, a lot of guys with expiring contracts after this year. So, you know, the biggest fear, I guess, was that things wouldn't quite go our way going into June and July. And, you know, obviously most people know the story. There's with injuries up and down the lineup and not being able to stay afloat in the NL East and in the wild card game or in the wild card come July. So once that started to creep up, all of us felt like there was a very good chance that most of us were going to be moved, and that was the case. So I think for all of us, our hope was that any of the guys that moved was that we would be able to go to a team that was in a playoff race, and I think almost all of us have. So we feel pretty fortunate about that. It's been certainly a crazy last 2 months, to say the least, just getting out of New York and moving the family and this and that. But here we are in Milwaukee and happy to be here and excited about these last 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think the average fan does not understand what that's like, to just in the middle of a season have to up and move your entire family, uproot everything and do that. But from a baseball standpoint, as you mentioned, it means you were going from a team that was struggling this season, that was beaten up, to one that's battling for a postseason spot. Look, I understand you're going to lay it on the line every single day, no matter where your team is in the standings, but how much of a lift is it when you get to go to the park knowing that every game does count still?
Well, it's huge, and it's it kind of rejuvenates your season, and you know, when things aren't going well, especially in a major market, the days and weeks can kind of drag on. And you know, I found as soon as I stepped into the locker room here in Milwaukee that the energy level was completely on another level. So that's exciting, especially as a veteran player, as a guy that's been around, and you know, the team is much younger here in Milwaukee. There's a lot of energy all day long, and you know, and it's exciting to just come in here and to, you know, be asked just to kind of play a role and to help the team in any way, shape, or form. And like I said, that's all you can ask for as a player.
We're talking to Neil Walker. Now, Neil, you're originally a Pittsburgh guy from Pine Richland High School, and then you were drafted by the Pirates, and you came up through the organization, which meant that you had plenty of experience of going up against the Brewers in Milwaukee. One of the things that comes up every single time I have a Brewer on this show is how great the Brewer fans are. What was it like to compete against the Brewers and their fans, and now what's it like to have that same group cheering for you?
Yeah, it certainly is a bit strange, and, you know, we lost a lot of games in Pittsburgh coming into Milwaukee. It was a tough place for us to play. The fan base was always really exciting, really loud. The ballpark was always loud. You know, especially 09 to 2012 when they had those great runs. And you know, to be on the other end of it is very interesting. But it's the same feeling that the crowd has been into it every single game that we've had here at home since I've been here. And you know, that ballpark gets very loud because it's so everything's kind of enclosed. So you know, it's exciting. It's gonna be a fun ride these last several weeks. We get a lot of division games coming up, and we kind of hold our own fate. So, you know, we're ready, and we're looking forward to the opportunity.
When I shattered one record after another with that unprecedented run of rants about the Jacksonville Jaguars, I did not expect to be coming back days later with another streak to rival that one. Now, something like that is a once-in-a-lifetime streak. Lightning in a bottle. Something that we could all just sit back and appreciate. I know I did. So then I did my take on the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Art Briles Tuesday. I hadn't talked about the CFL in a long time. No Tiger Cats talk. No Blue Bombers bashing. No Red Blacks roundtable. No Argonauts arguing. I had not done anything on the Rough Riders with a space or the Rough Riders without a space in a long time. So I had to think that Tuesday was a one-off. Man, I was wrong. Because here we are, 48 hours later, and the Ticats are back at it again. Just days after they hired Art Briles and then fired Art Briles in a matter of hours. Now comes word from TSN that Hamilton worked out one Jonathan Paul Manziel last week. They really are looking to outdo themselves. That's a hell of a week now. Hire a guy who ran one of the worst programs in America and then work out one of the biggest busts in America. Fantastic job, Hamilton. But I've got to give him credit. They're trying everything. And kicking the tires on Manziel, unfortunately for Johnny, went about as well as you might expect. According to TSN, quote, among other concerns, the Ticats were not convinced Manziel is in game shape or that his off-field regimen is consistent with that of someone dedicated to professional football, end quote. Or to put it another way, there were, according to one source, quote, too many red flags. Stop on that for a minute. Ponder that for a minute. Because that's got to be the most damning thing that's ever been said about Johnny Manziel. And it's not even close. The team that hired Art Briles looked at Manziel and thought, too many red flags. They brought in a guy who cannot get a job in America. A guy who ran a program where his players were accused of more than 50 rapes in 4 years. And that was all right with the Ticats. But they saw Manziel and thought, oh, no. Too many red flags. I mean, incredible. But according to PFT, it's not completely dead yet. The team is still interested in him, and there's still a chance that Manziel could end up in Hamilton. Red flags and all. I mean, I'm not even sure how to react other than to say, that's just Hamilton going Hamilton. And no, this is not going to turn to some chance for the rest of you Canadian clones to dump on the proud, shiny, and up-and-coming city of Hamilton. This is not about the city that gave us Martin Short and Tim Horton. This is about the football team that's 0-8 and making one bizarre decision after another. Let's hire Art Briles. Let's give Johnny Manziel a workout. Hey, maybe they should check out RG3. Oh, wait. They actually do already have his rights. Of course they do. How much more Hamilton Tiger Cat could you get than a potential quarterback depth chart of RG3 and Manziel and Art Briles calling the plays? What? Jawalrus Ruffles didn't want any of that? O.J. Simpson's going to be released in a little over a month. At this rate, you know the Ticats are going to want to know what he's got left in the tank. I've gone years without mentioning the Tiger Cats, but now I've gone deep on them twice in a single week. Can I make it a hat trick tomorrow? I'm not going to force it. In fact, I'm going to avoid it. But knowing the Ticats, they're going to do something and force their way right back onto this show. And then we'll be looking at three. We are joined right now by Tom Izzo. Tom, good morning. It's so good to have you on the show. Tom, how are you?
Well, I'm great, Jim. And the guy with that kind of introduction, I don't know if I can live up to it. It sounded a lot better than I feel sometimes, but I'm great. Thanks. It's great to be on again.
My man, you've had a legendary career as well, so you earned all that. Tom, I'm calling you up because Judd Heathcote did pass away on Monday in Spokane at the age of 90. And given what he's meant to your program, to that university, and to you personally, what was your reaction when you heard that news?
Well, you know what, like everybody, you know, I talked to Scott Skiles, Steve Smith last night. They both kind of said the same thing. You know, you shed a tear. We had gone out there to see him last summer, so that was good. But, you know, you shed the tear. You felt bad. I knew how he was feeling. I knew that he wasn't happy because he wasn't as mobile as he would, but his mind was still great. But then, Jim, what I did is I started to do, my father died a year and a half ago, and I said, just think of all the great times. And I started thinking of all the funny moments, and I happened to go to my NABC meetings in Kansas City yesterday, and he was a member of that board for a long time, and everybody there had a Judd story, and I said, the unique thing is you all have one story. I got 1,000 of those stories, so think how blessed I am, you know, 1,000 of those jokes that he told. But it was, I found a way to remember and appreciate not only that I wouldn't be here without him, but all the great times I had with him.
Tom isn't my guest. Tom, I'm so glad that that's the approach and the way you're looking at this right now. In fact, you're right. Everybody has a Judd story, and you've got thousands. Do you have a particular favorite Judd story?
I still think one of my favorites is when on his Goodwill tour that he took. You know, he went to Illinois, and it was the year before his tour, I should say, and he bumped head. And so on the tour the next year, Lou Henson brought him out a football helmet to put on when he coached. And, you know, there were just a million things like that. Jim, he had the ability to do something. I think you do a good job of it. I hope I do, but I don't think it's common. He could laugh at himself, you know. He could make fun of himself. He could laugh at himself. I think guys that are confident and maybe give people a lot of crap have learned how to take it in return, and he was one of those kind of guys.
Such a good point. Tom Izzo joining us. Now, Tom, the story of how you got started at Michigan State is also legendary. Like the fact that you went to him multiple times, including once with a broken jaw, to try to convince him to hire you, and then he finally brought you on as a graduate assistant. Why did you want to work at Michigan State and for Judd in particular so badly?
Well, you know, years in college, and I came as a senior right when Magic was coming in and everything, so that's all you heard about was Magic Johnson. We had a couple guys from Iron Mountain, the UP, where I was from, that played football here. Steve Mariucci, my best friend, his dad went to school here. There was kind of a Michigan State connection way up north in the UP where I'm from. And they had won a national championship a few years earlier. And I was just, you know, trying to get on. I'd come down here for a coaching clinic and enjoyed the campus. But he did. He turned me down 3 times. Last time I did have a broken jaw. I just come from California. I was the best man at Mariucci's wedding with a broken jaw, and I got here and interviewed, and he still mimicked me 20 years later on how I interviewed. But he turned me down, and I found out a little while later he had a GA job open. I said, well, what about that? And he said, you're too qualified. And I said, well, that's my problem. And he hired me. 3 years later, he hired me as a full-time guy, and then the career went upward from there. But it was a rocky start.
Michigan State head coach Tom Izzo joining us. Rocky because he wouldn't let you start, and then you finally did. And Tom, frankly, you were not making very much money at the time. What were the early days like?
Well, my first 3 years, I made $4,500 a year and as a GA, and I was, a lot of things to him, but gopher was probably the greatest word he used a lot of times, and it was good for me, though. I was 27, 28, 29 years old, somewhere in there. Most GAs are 23, 4, and 5. And so, because I went the Division II route and I was an assistant there for a couple of years, it was a little later. But, you know, it was good for me. It was good. It was a great guy to learn from. I mean, the guy, he never asked me to do something he didn't do himself. He taught me how to deal with the media. You know, he felt you guys all had jobs to do. When I was mad at the media when I was an assistant with him because they, you know, maybe writing something about firing him and this and that, he always said, remember in this job, you know, they too have a job to do and a boss to please. And I've kind of stuck with that my 23 years, and it's served me well. It makes me understand things just like I want sometimes you guys to understand things. It makes me have an appreciation and understanding for you. So even a guy that seems so volatile in all this, very, very intelligent man. You know, he had his master's in mathematics. He was working on his doctorate in mathematics, and very smart man.
Tom Izzo joining us. We're talking about Judd Heathcote. You know, on top of all that, he also, Tom, he had this, like, I mean, college coaches obviously generally have this, or they would not rise to the place that they have in their profession. But he had, like, so much it, man. He had this amazing personality, this amazing presence, this great it. But at the end of the day, he was a coach's coach. And you hear that phrase all the time. How would you define a coach's coach, and what made him that?
Well, he was a guy that appreciated all coaches. You know, he appreciated football coaches and baseball. He loved baseball, baseball coaches. He treated people, you know, he was a high school coach for 18 years. So we still have a rule here. Anytime a high school coach wants to come to practice, it's never closed to a high school coach. I think he treated everybody the same. I always told people he treated everybody the same, bad. You know, he always treated us all tough. He was always, when I was a GA, when I was assistant, when I was an associate head coach, and even when I became the head coach, you know, I'm going to miss those phone calls on why I didn't play more zone or what I did wrong. And he used to do the same to the football guys here. You know, you should have thrown, you should have done this. I said, Judd, what if George Perlis said that to you, you know? And he always looked at things that way. A coach's coach to me means he treated everybody with the same level. And that was no matter what sport you were in, no matter what level you were at. And I appreciated that greatly.
Yeah, Tom, you mentioned he would call you up after games. And I know you probably love those calls. And maybe not everything about those calls. But when he mentioned, and you know he loved a good zone defense. Oh. But could you ever play enough zone defense for his liking?
You know, the worst part is I hardly play any, as you know, Jim. But part of the reason, you know, when he had Magic, they played zone. They played that 2-3 matchup. And most of my career as an assistant here, we played a lot of man-to-man. So I always told him, he says, why won't you play more zone? And I said, I always tell him I had a bad mentor. Never taught me well enough. And then my second line was always, listen, if you can get Magic to come back and finish his last 2 years here, I'll play zone. Because he was so good in the back of that zone. He would communicate with everybody, you know. And so those are the two reasons I don't. But he chewed me out, including this summer, Jim. So, well, you got a good team coming back. You're going to play a little zone. So you hit the nail on the head. It's something that he'll be telling the man up above that when he gets up there.
Yeah, I would imagine, Tom, that if he chewed you out even at that age this summer, when you did work for him, you probably never, ever had to wonder if he was mad at you, right? It was always pretty obvious if you were.
I never, ever, ever, Jim, ever went home 12 straight years and let me tell you, there weren't a lot of vacation days back then with him, and I never left the office. And I wonder if Judd's mad at me.
Right.
I always knew he was. So it was, and I say that in a great way. I mean, I think he had a great ability to never be satisfied, but in a proper way. You know, he was always pushing me to be better. And again, this past year, still pushing me to be better. You know, and he could watch a game. He had a very good insight, you know, even though I didn't always want to agree with him, he had a very good insight. And what I caught myself doing over these last 10 years, especially, Jim, was my secretary was here when Judd was here. And every once in a while, I'll still walk in the office and say, hey, Lori, now I know why Judd did this, because it was something I didn't like. But as I went through my career, I had a better appreciation and understanding. And I think that's the one great point about him. I don't think that'll change for me. I think I'll constantly have Juddisms that make me a better coach as the years go on.
My man Alex Solis in studio. Alex, it is so good to have you here in studio. How are you? What's going on?
Everything's good, man. Thank you for having me. Also, just hanging out and came to talk with you, see how it all goes.
Well, it's good. It's going to go great. And we're still in the meet at Del Mar, so I know you've got some business. Now, Alex, you manage all of our equine interests for Jungle Racing, top to bottom. But technically what you are is a bloodstock agent. Now, remember, you're talking to a non-equine audience. So let me start right there. What does a bloodstock agent do? What is your job?
So a basic bloodstock agent, their job would be to go to a sale or to purchase horses privately for clients. We take it up a level and we try to do full management. So we do everything from the moment we buy that horse from the sale for you. We go ahead and we plan who's going to break the horse, what trainer's going to get it, and then basically try to place the horse in the right spot. And then when they get up to a certain distance of training, we know where what kind of races are placing him in. And once, hopefully, they turn into good ones, you get to pick out a stake schedule, which is really the fun part.
Alex Solis joining me. So in reality, I mean, you've picked all of our horses, but then as a full service agency, you do more than that. I mean, you purchase the horse, but then you manage it and you help us find the trainers and where to run the horses. Now, your background is really interesting. Your father is a Hall of Fame jockey, Alex Solis. So you grew up around the barn. You grew up around the track. The thing that you're doing right now, is this what you always wanted to do, or was there a different plan?
No, this is actually something I started as a hobby. I always worked on the backside and wanted to train horses, so you have to put your time in. And I was lucky enough to work for some trainers that had really good eyes to pick horses out. So just started just kind of messing with it on my own, and it worked out. And the training thing was always my dream. And, it would be a great thing to do, but to be a trainer is really difficult because the hours they put in it's pretty crazy. They're at the barn usually from 3:30 to about 5 p.m. at night, and that's 7 days a week. You really don't get days off.
3:30 in the morning.
Yeah, so it's a brutal thing. So I think I picked the right career.
Okay, but did you pick the right career, or did the right career pick you? As an example, so you had the dream and you want to be a trainer, but it's a hard, hard, brutal life. So you just went to college. I mean, you were going to go a normal college route. What did you study in college, and what was your plan when you got there?
So when I started in college, I was actually going to try to become a veterinarian to train my own horses. Halfway through, I was still working at the barn and going to school, and I was like, I can't do this. This is way too much going on. And then I actually switched to a finance degree, and I started working for a brokerage firm in Pasadena. And one of my clients, actually Jeff Davenport, and started messing with the horses with him. And right off the bat, we hit Daytona. And he's like, what are you doing here? Let's go find some more horses. And that's how it all really started.
So in other words, you were like in a brokerage firm and you were just living that life, that normal finance life. And then the guys at the firm were saying, hey man, let's do some horse stuff. You know horses, let's do that.
That was all. That was it. They were right on the money, and it's been all a blast, and we still all do stuff together, so it's great.
Alex Solis joining me. He's our bloodstock agent. Listen, if you want to talk horse racing and you've got a question for Alex, you want to talk about the sport, if you want to talk about any horse whatsoever, this is a rare opportunity. You know, we don't do this very much. The telephone number is toll-free, 1-800-636-8686. So then you're in this thing full-time, and you put Janet and I would say, Alex, like, we might be known for a couple of horses, but we've been in literally dozens of different partnerships and opportunities in the business, and a lot of them people don't know, but they know about Misdirection and they know about Shared Belief. Shared Belief at one point was the top-ranked thoroughbred in the entire world. It's an astonishing thing. Like, I don't know if you can answer this, but if you had to guess, how many thoroughbreds worldwide are running right now, if you had to guess?
Well, just in the U.S., the full crop's always, with everything's about 40,000, so the whole world, gosh, you got to be talking... Got to be saying 400,000 to 500,000.
400,000 to 500,000 horses.
Yeah.
So Shared Belief at one point was the top ranked thoroughbred in the entire world. Why don't you tell that story for those who don't know? How did you find Shared Belief?
Yeah, that was, being in the right place at the right time. Jerry had been talking about some horses up north he really liked.
Jerry Hollendorfer,
sorry, the trainer. And he called me and he said, hey, did you see this race at Golden Gate? He said, I have a horse I like in there. And he just got blown away. He said, see what you think. So I watched the race, called my partner. I said, hey, this thing looks really impressive. And Jason's like, well, if you like it, let's try to get it done. So Jerry started talking to the owner, and I called Jim, and the rest is history. We just got on as quick as possible. The whole thing was a crazy deal because the guy said he wanted a price, and I was like, instantly, I know better than to jump the gun, but I jumped the gun. I was like, all right, fine, we'll give you the money. And the guy's like, well, I want more than that then. We're like, all right, fine. And, we were lucky enough to be right.
Yeah, so why, though? That's not like you. You don't do that. You never pay what they ask, much less give them what they ask. And when they said, okay, I want more, and then you said yes to that, why? Why did you do that with that horse?
He was so brilliant in his debut, and I thought, I've always been a big Candy Ride fan, and when Jerry's telling you he liked the one that ran second...
Candy Ride was his sire.
Sorry, yeah. Candy Ride's his sire. He was a brilliant racehorse himself. He was undefeated, and the moment he went to stud, he started breeding. His first crop of horses, he had a couple Grade One winners, and he looked like he could be a super stallion. And so this little horse from Golden Gate goes and breaks his maiden impressively. And he did everything right. And just knowing values of horses, the first number he came with was too low for what he was. And so that's why I jumped the gun. But, the moment he said yes to the second number, I was out there the next morning at 4:30 to look at him to make sure I liked the physical. And, everyone was on board. We got the deal done. And, 3 weeks later, we got to run him in a graded stake. And that was the first moment of brilliance you saw was, he beat a horse by the name of Kobe's Back who broke his maiden in a stake race. He didn't even go to a maiden. That horse was supposed to be the real deal. And I saw him at the sale, and I was like, ah, Kobe's Back. And I actually tried to buy him for another client. So when I saw him entered in the race, I was like, oh, man, I just paid X for this horse, and I'm hoping he can be a Hall of Futurity horse. The race is $500,000. I was thinking, you know what? Let's see what we can do here. And then when he beat Kobe's Back the way he did, it gave me an idea we had something special. You never want to get ahead of yourself, but that was wow.
Alex Soli is joining us. He's a bloodstock agent. He represents our interests as well as many others. And we're talking about shared beliefs. So Alex found this horse. Alex purchased this horse, put together the investment group that owned the horse. And we talked about how we had that race against Kobe's Back. And you knew Kobe's Back. It's like you're like a talent scout for athletes. You know all these horses. You almost bought the horse that we were going up against. And then we get shared belief. One more thing about this horse, Alex. The horse was a gelding, meaning he couldn't breed. He had been cut. So that reduced his value. Listen, you're a sharp guy. The guy who sold us the horse is a very, very sharp guy. Was it not in the back of your mind, why are they selling this horse? What's wrong with this horse? Why would they sell a horse that just won that brilliantly?
And Marty Weigod's a smart guy, and he's in the business long term, and he's mostly in the breeding game. So he was thinking, at the end of the day, he could take a nice profit off the horse, and he owns shares in Twirling Candy, and he owns the mare, and everything's good for him. So, yeah, he went along and sold the horse. He knew there's no – usually with a gelding, there's no huge payout. So he was just playing his cards close to, conservatively, and he sold the horse. But in the back of my mind, my job is to find horses that can run in big races and value. And I thought, for that price, could we get out on the horse and could have fun? And that's exactly what I thought. I'm like, this is a good play to have some fun.
We didn't know, though, that we had bought a champion. We didn't know that we would have one day the best horse in the world. So shared belief wins the race you're talking about, the Hollywood Preview. Then he wins the next race, which was the Cash Call Futurity. And then all of a sudden, you and I are on a plane to go to Florida to accept the award for the 2-year-old male champ, the Eclipse Award, which is a big, big deal. And you said to me at that point, you looked at me, you said, Jim, whatever you do, do not get Derby fever. Do not get Derby fever. We're 5 months from the Kentucky Derby. It's the worst thing you can do. And I said, quote, bro, I got this. I'm fine. And of course, I got Derby fever and I got caught. And then Alex, the horse, got hurt. And then our rival California Chrome just blew up and started to win everything big. Our horse is on the sideline. Our rival down the street is killing it. I know what I was thinking at that time. What was going through your mind when we knew we had a horse that probably was as good as that horse and could have won the Derby, but he was hurt?
To be honest, I just tried not to think about it because it's sitting there. If you think about it, it's going to get to you. And so I was just trying to keep myself from thinking about it and looking up and forward saying, okay, well, let's get through this foot issue and, hopefully he'll be our Breeders' Cup horse. And, he did more than that before the Breeders' Cup. When he beat older horse in the Pacific Classic, it was like, wow, that's a day that everyone dreams about. Delmar's going on right now. The Pacific Classic just ran last weekend, and that was a race I always dreamed about winning. For him to go and win it as a 3-year-old, the way he did, beating a horse like Game On Dude and those horses, that was a surreal moment in itself. If you told me this horse is never going to be champion 2-year-old, he's going to win the Pacific Classic, I'd be like, this is a slam dunk home run. For him to do everything he did was pretty special.
Listen, when you and I got into business, if you had said to me that I'll get you a runner in the Pacific Classic, not only a winner or a 3-year-old that could beat older, I would have said, oh, sign me up. What's it cost just to get in? Put those on real quick because I got a couple of phone calls for you. Alex Solis joining me in studio. Let me go to Wisconsin. Mark in Wisconsin. Mark, you're on with Alex Solis. Mark, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Great.
My mother actually went to high school with Dwayne Lucas up in Anago, Wisconsin. And I was just wondering, what does it take? Because Dwayne Lucas actually went to Madison, graduated high school, and was a high school basketball coach for 9 years. And then about 40 years later, started training horses and is probably arguably the greatest trainer out there these days. What is the steps that goes into that?
Let me jump in there, Mark. So, Alex, Dwayne Lucas pretty well. He's a legend of the game. What makes him a great trainer? And why has he had the career he's had?
The way horses are trained now, Wayne Lucas changed the game. Before, the game used to be all about stamina, pedigree racing, at a slower pace, and really the race turned on at the quarter pole. Well, what Wayne Lucas did, he actually started with the quarter horses, and he was the first quarter horse trainer to come into the game. And so he introduced brilliant speed, and he trained horses harder than anyone else ever did. And he put them on the front end because there's no kickback coming at them. And he said, you know, if I can get a mile or be a great mile on a quarter horse, I can win those races. And so the game is now what it is because of that guy. And Bob Baffert, he came from the quarter horse game. Same thing. Their horses are always placed forwardly, and it is an advantage. So, yeah, that's why Wayne Lucas has just crushed it.
Alex Solis joining me in studio. This is interesting, Alex. This guy's got a question on line one that you and I have dealt with before, and I want him to ask this question of you and I right now. Jose in Los Angeles. Jose, nice to have you on. How are you?
Hey, what's up, Jim? How you doing?
Good, good.
Hey, what's up, Alex?
How are you? Everything good?
Good, good. Yeah, I just, you know, we just found about the retirement of Songbird today, and, you know, she was one of those deals that it also got announced she's going to be put up for sale later on this year, and it's one of those deals where you have a great horse, and instead of keeping him, you know, racing and breeding on your own, get a side of sell. So I just wanted to see what your thought process was about that decision, because I know you guys went through it with Misdirection.
Okay, it's a great question. I'm glad. Alex, really quickly to set this up, Misdirection was a mare that you also purchased and put together the partnership, and we were majority owners with some other partners. She won the Breeders' Cup back-to-back. She was just five. Horses can run beyond that, and we decided to sell her, and we got some flack for that. Like, hey, Rome, why are you so greedy? Hey, Rome, why don't you run that horse? Help explain why we sold her when we did.
Yeah, Rick Porter's going to go into the same thing right now. Most operations either have plans to be racing horses or breeding operations completely. And Rick Porter's been in the game long enough that he had a filly named Havre de Grace. He's doing the same thing with her. She was Horse of the Year. He sold her for $10 million. He is not a breeding operation. He really doesn't breed at all, and he's a racing operation. Kind of the same aspect Jim and I were in with Misdirection. We bought her to be a racehorse originally. Jim bought in with the idea in the contract saying when she's done with her career, she'd be sold as a broodmare. And at the end of the day, you have to sell them at their peak value. That's what you try to, at least, because that's how you can stay in the game the longest. But yeah, he's not a breeding operation, neither were we, and it's a smart thing to do. And at the end of the year is when all the big broodmare sales are, so it's perfect timing. They can get her 100% before the sale. She'll look great, and she'll sell well.
Can I say this also very quickly? Number two, we want to stay in the game, and it's so hard to make money and take money off the table. We took some of that money off the table, and we reinvested in the game, and we bought Share Belief. So that's something. Number two, Alex, my feeling was she was a champion. She was a world champion. They never get to go out on top. I didn't want greedy by keeping in her. I wanted to get her off the track and let her live the life of a horse and go out on top. That was important to me too, personally.
Of course, and the harder part is when you think about it. If you don't have, like, not every good racehorse is a great stallion, or every great race mare is a great broodmare. So unless you have a bunch of these and you have a big breeding operation, the risk to take as a smaller investor in the game, it's just too much. They become worth way too much for your portfolio.
And we knew that she'd pull a number, and she did.
Exactly.
Very quickly. One last call. We go to Niagara Falls. Diana, you made it on with Alex Solis. Quickly, how are you?
Hi, Alex.
Thank you,
Jim. What an honor to speak with you. Hey, Alex, do you see any resemblance between Share Belief and Gunrunner, another candy ride?
All right, so it's such a great question, because we're partners with Ron Winchell, who owns Gunrunner. What do you think? They're both candy rides.
You know, what's funny enough was when Gunrunner was at the 2-year-old sale at OBS March, Niall Brennan had the horse. He never went through the ring. And I got a phone call from Doug Coffin of Three Chimneys, and they had bred the horse. And I said, hey, what do you think about Gunrunner? And I said, you know, his name wasn't Gunrunner at the time. And I said, oh, he's a nice, you know, big scopey colt. He's pretty, you know, well-balanced. It reminds me a little bit of Share Belief, you know, different colors in the whole nine yards. But yeah, he definitely has the candy ride brilliance, the speed. You know, I don't know if he's as versatile as Share Belief was, but yeah, physically there is some resemblance. He's a bigger, stouter horse, though.
Got about 30 seconds, Alex. Bottom line, when you and I are biased, is Share Belief a Hall of Famer? Will he get in the Hall of Fame one day?
You know, I would hope so. His race record speaks for itself. His only two defeats are when, you know, he came out of the gate in the Breeders' Cup Classic and everything went the wrong way, and he still showed up and ran fourth. And then, you know, when he got hurt at Charlestown. So with all the horses he beat, and you think he could go, California Chrome will get the Hall of Fame. And we, you know, on our best day and his best day, we proved we were a better horse. Like, I truly believe if Share Belief stayed healthy up to the Triple Crown, you would never hurt a California Chrome, because he just wasn't in the same league, I don't believe.
Let's go to Boston. Mark in Boston. And when you've got that kind of game, you don't wait. Right to the front of the line. Mark, what's up?
Hi. Hey, Jim. You know, that Mayweather-McGregor fight has got me totally pumped up for college football season. You know it's football season when the Fighting Irish lose on Saturdays. But I did lose a little bit of money on that fight, considering I bet McGregor would go down between rounds 4 and 8. And speaking of that, Notre Dame, lamest of all college football mascots. Imagine the kid who strives to get into that school and then is asked to be the mascot. So you just put on this leprechaun uniform and jump around and punch at the camera and think about all the wrestling you won't be doing for the next 4 years. Oh, sorry, Jim, my bad. I hope I didn't offend your boy Dave Whelan there. I forgot he was a leprechaun. Anyway, this is my first call post-smack-off. I thought that SI picture was pretty cool, despite all the dudes in the picture looking younger now in 2017 than they did in 96. Not sure it was in the water back then. When IRA walked in, Jim, did you expect him to be followed by Chris Hansen? And I noticed Randall was hunched over in that photo. Was I afraid he's earned really that heavy, dude? And I want to say congrats to Matt Stafford for his $135 million extension. That's like $67 million per move. Now that he's the highest paid player in the NFL, he can bail on the Lions like Barry and Megatron did. And seriously, if Matt Stafford is worth $135 million, then they should just give Aaron Rodgers a franchise. Congrats, Aaron. You now own the Jacksonville Jaguars. That contract is going to steal the show. And Aaron Rodgers is single now, so he definitely falls into that tenderoni category. As a Lions fan, I wouldn't be entirely against Danica completely shattering his pelvis. War Michigan punking Florida and Dallas, and war Jim McElwain in a San Jose Sharks jersey. JT was short.
Clones, thanks so much for listening. Thank you for making the new Jim Rome podcast an absolute monster on iTunes. Episode 1 rolled out with Aaron Rodgers and Paulie Malignaggi. Bob Costas already set for episode 2 next Tuesday. Make sure you're subscribed to that podcast as well. And check back right here tomorrow for more Daily Jungle.